Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. One thing I've learned from producing these podcasts is that the research never ends. It only leads to new avenues of interest branching off from the original topic. And this is the case for Peter Lyon. If you recall in episode 33, Peter told us how elements of the US 28th Infantry Division stationed in the Luxembourg town of Wiltz put on a Christmas party for the local children. This included Richard Brookins dressing as St. Nicholas and arriving by jeep to hand out gifts to the kids. In researching that, Peter bumped into the story of George Mercenthaler, heir to the Mercenthaler Lino type company. I've been trying to pin down a guest for an extra episode for quite a while, so when Peter proposed we discuss his book, Merg, I jumped at the chance. So you'll get three episodes of the podcast this month. Now, for patrons of the podcast, I make available parts of the interviews that are off topic or just never made it into the final cut. Well, I have a bit more of Peter chatting and I've decided to release it free to everyone as a big thank you for listening and all the support you've given me. So if you want to listen to it, you can find it at patreon.com/WW2podcast. If you're not already a patron, why not sign up for more World War II talk when I have it available? A dollar or two each month goes a long way. Or even push out the boat and commit at a Rockefeller level of support like listener MKAZ003. Thank you, Michael, for your support. Peter, thanks for joining me. So this is an extension of your research in respect to your book, American Nick. So if people haven't listened to episode 33, they should go listen and get the full story. But I wondered where in that story does George Mercenthaler's story intersect?
Well, the funny thing is he's not. They're actually two separate stories, okay? Where the intersection lies is in my discovery of the story of George Mercenthaler. And that happened because I happened to be in Wiltz, Luxembourg, with the American St. Nicholas, St. Nick, who was Richard Brookins. And this was probably 15 years ago. And we were sitting at a cafe and we were just chatting. And he said, "Did I ever tell you the story about George Mercenthaler in the church up in Eschweiler?" And I said, "No, you never did." He goes, "Oh, come on, let's go." I was like, "Go where?" He goes, "Come on, we'll go to Eschweiler," which is only 4 miles away. And so we hopped in my rental car and we drove the 4 miles and he brings me to Eschweiler, which is this little map dot town. I mean, you could go literally, as I say in the book, in one in and out the other before you know he'd even been there. But at the elbow of the main street through town is this little church. And he says, "Come on, you got to go in the church." All right, so we go in the church. And once I walked in the church and I saw it for myself, that's when I was blown away and I was hooked. And that really is the only intersection between the two stories. That and both of the stories involve the 28th Infantry Division. Okay, that's a major intersection. Like when the Hurricane Forest battle was raging, they, after 2 weeks, get pulled out and sent to the west, to rearward, to be, you know, to rest and recuperate and all that, taken out of the frontline fighting, where as they're sent west, this little recon troop of about 60 guys ends up in this small town of Eschweiler. So they're, you know, they're all in the same division. It's just this was a different a part of the division than St. Nick was.
So let's look at the story of George
Mercenthaler.
Mercenthaler. I don't know why I've been stumbling over it. I've been looking it up on the internet. How do you pronounce it? I can't get it out. So he's a translator for a US recon trip. With a name like that, he must be of, is he German extraction? Where does his ability to speak German come from?
well, he grew up speaking German because his grandfather, who he never met, by the way, had come to the United States as a German immigrant back in, you know, the early 1800s, famously with a gold watch and $30 in his pocket, and that was it. And his grandfather had this very keen sense of of mechanics, and he had the ability to look at any piece of machinery, no matter what it was. And remember, this was during the Industrial Revolution and all that kind of time frame. He could look at any piece of machinery and just know immediately why it worked, how it worked, why it didn't work, how it could work better. It was just this gift he had of seeing the machine as a whole versus just a collection of parts. And that's what made him such a great draftsman. Now, again, Industrial Revolution, at that time, there were so many inventors out there that were trying to, you know, get their inventions
patented.
Patented, yes, thank you. So in order to get it patented with the U.S. Patent Office, they needed to have a diagram. They needed to have, you know, basically a how-to form of this is how, you know, the parts get connected. So they would go to this machine shop where this guy, Otmar, his reputation had grown, and he was an incredible draftsman. So he would draft all their machines for patent. And, you know, again, he could look at it and say, I'm going to draw this, but I can tell you why it's not going to work. People didn't want to hear it, and they went ahead and had it patented anyway. Otmar Mergenthaler was eventually presented with this machine that looked like a typewriter. What the inventor was trying to do was to try to make a machine that would mass print newspapers, because at that time, no newspaper in the world was more than 8 pages long, and it just simply couldn't be if they had to go out and get the news, collect the news, write the news, edit it, typeset it, get it printed, and then distribute it in any, you know, meaningful time frame. It couldn't be any longer than that. That was it. At that time, you have to remember that there had not been an advancement in the printing industry since the Gutenberg press. Okay, so there's like 400-year void of any major printing accomplishment. And at that time, that was really the only way people were communicating, was with print media. So, you know, the communications industry field, if you will, was eager to find something. So a lot of inventors were out there trying to find a way to mass print newspapers and things like that. So this guy shows up to the machine shop with this somewhat, you know, bulky typewriter type machine that might work and didn't. And Otmar says, okay, I can tell you why it's not going to work. And I can help you build a better one if you'd so desire. So anyway, this inventor gets some backing, and Otmar gets on his way, and he starts to invent this machine to mass print newspapers. And he eventually, after, you know, a few years, invents the linotype machine. And the linotype machine revolutionized the printing industry. The name was coined by Whitelaw Reed, who was the publisher of the New York Tribune newspaper, where they demoed this linotype machine, and literally Otmar Mergenthaler sat at a keyboard, typed in some words, and out pops this line of type. and it was Whitelaw Reed that said, oh my God, Otmar, you've done it. It's a line of type. And that's how the name stuck, linotype. Well, the linotype machine went into mass production as a result of that. Newspapers around the world wanted their hands on this thing. It made the Mergenthaler family famous and wealthy beyond anything they could possibly comprehend. Now, the family, though, as I always say, it was a family blessed with prosperity but cursed with tragedy. Otmar himself died from tuberculosis at the age of 44, and he died in 1899, okay? At that time, his estate was valued somewhere around $43 million, and that was in 1899. 20 years later, his grandson, George Mergenthaler, is born. And at that time, he is the only living male heir to this vast Mergenthaler fortune. And all of that is covered in the book as how that comes to be. So George grew up speaking to his father, Hermann, who spoke German, obviously, grandson of Otmar, or son of Otmar, and his grandmother, who also spoke German. So he grew up speaking German, and when he went into school and had to take language courses, he took German, because why not? So he was fluent in German, but he also took French and became very fluent in French as well. So when he went into the army, or was, you know, drafted into the army, it wasn't long before they recognized his abilities with language and said, you're going in a recon troop. That's where we could use you. And that's how he got assigned to recon.
I had to do printing technology at university years ago, a module, and it bored me senseless. But I have to say, the story of the linotype machine, I was completely enthralled by, because I understood how vastly important that was. So that module on print technology has been sat with me for the last, you know, 30 years waiting for me to read that and realize why I did that module and it means something to me.
Well, you know, when you think about it, and this is the truth, that machine, his linotype machine, was so perfect in its, not only its conception, but in its mechanics, that aside from a few minor parts changes that happened through the evolution of the machining and die and tool making and all that, aside from minor tweaks, the machine remained virtually unchanged for nearly 100 years. I mean, it was only when photo typesetting came along that machine was done and outdated. But if you think about that, that's how perfect, absolutely perfect his design was. And you have to give him credit for that.
Absolutely amazing. So, George Mergenthaler, he's at Princeton, isn't he, when America enters the war? What's his reaction to the outbreak of war?
Well, I mean, like so many of his generation, he was in Princeton University. Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and not long after that, he and a bunch of his classmates they went and enlisted. Now he enlisted in the army against his father's wishes. His father had been in the Navy in World War I, and was just dead set against having his only son, his only child, enlist in the military, but. Being a very wealthy family and, being in Princeton University and obviously Ivy League educated, his father was thinking, oh, no problem. I'll use my money and influence to get my son, maybe assigned as an aide to a general or maybe even stateside service or whatever. He was trying to like pull all the strings. And George would have none of it. George just said, no, I want to serve my country as a private, as just a simple buck private. So that's what he did. That's what he insisted on. And everybody, that he served with, everybody in the recon troop knew that he could have probably and should have been an officer. And in fact, many of the officers would turn to him for counseling and advice. But he insisted on serving as a private just because he wanted to be accepted as just one of the guys. He didn't want, he grew up having a life of privilege, obviously, because he was brutally wealthy. He was smart, Ivy League educated. He also had movie star good looks. This is literally a guy that had it all, and he just wanted to be accepted as just one of the guys. And so that's why he insisted on serving as a buck private. And when the war broke, or I should say when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, as I say, he enlisted, but his enlistment was deferred until he graduated. And he graduated in January of 1943 on an accelerated program. And literally days after his graduation, he was shipped off to Camp Hood, Texas. At that time, it was Camp Hood, not Fort Hood, because he volunteered for tank destroyer detail. And at the time, the U.S. Army was very well aware of the German armor efficiency and the way they sort of just cleaved their way through Europe. And they needed something to counter that. So they said, all right, well, we're gonna develop this tank destroyer division. So George volunteered for that, but he was rather tall. And wouldn't quite fit into the equipment, but he never really got that far because once they found out that he did speak fluent German and French, again the army was like, no, we've got better plans for you. You would be best served in a recon troop because you can get out there in front and interrogation and just interviewing the local citizens. No, that's where you're going to go. So they assigned him to the 28th Cavalry Recon Troop, which was assigned to the 28th Infantry Division. A lot of 28s in there, but they were two separate things. And he gets assigned to the 28th Infantry Division. And so he ends up with this division as one of the members of this recon troop. And that took them into the UK for basic training beginning in October of 43. And they were there from October in Wales, in St. Clair's, Wales, from basically October of 43 right through to May of 44 when they were then marshaled toward Tidworth, England, before they were sent over to France, right after the D-Day invasion. They weren't part of the D-Day invasion. They actually went in with the rest of the division a month afterwards in July.
That's with the D-Day division. That's with the Keystone Division. Is that right?
Correct, the Keystone Division. Yeah, the Keystone Division was is the 28th Infantry Division, which was originally the Pennsylvania National Guard, and the Pennsylvania state symbol is this keystone. And what the infantry division did is they went with a red shoulder patch. And it was it had many nicknames, one of which was the Bucket of Blood Division, because it the German soldiers after the Hürtgen Forest thought that the red keystones looked like buckets of blood, because that's how devastating that one particular battle for this division was. And we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but in the Hürtgen Forest, where the 28th had been for about 2 weeks during November of 1944, the fighting was brutal, and a lot of that is documented in the book, and it's you know, inhumane in some respects. When they were cycled out of the fighting, about two and a half weeks later, 2/3 of the division were casualties. So that's 6,000 guys were casualties of this one battle alone. And again, they get shipped to the west, to the rear, to rest and recuperate, and to basically resupply and to get more troops, because their division had been absolutely decimated in that one battle.
One question it did occur to me. He's from this fabulously wealthy family. He's not an officer. He chooses not to become an officer, or if he's going to be an officer, he's going to go from the bottom up. I wondered how aware people were of his background, because, well, I talked to someone about Jimmy Stewart a couple of months ago, and it was one of those things where people were a bit nervous about having them in their unit because they didn't want celebrity to affect their unit. And he kind of, you know, his family clearly must have had money brings influence.
Well, it did. And you're absolutely right. He was actually very guarded about his background. In the recon troop, he was part of the headquarters platoon. And his best friend at the time was a soldier by the name of Cletus Lafond. And Cletus was he and Cletus bonded. They became fast friends and best buds. And Cletus was the only one who knew his true history, his background, that he was that wealthy. But, you know, they knew that the rest of the troop knew that he, you know, quote unquote, came from money, but they didn't know like how much money. They had no idea to the degree of which, you know, the amount of wealth this guy had. But they also knew simply because he was generous to a fault. Anything he would get from home. And his mother was always sending him like all kinds of baked treats and just everything. And his father, who basically ran his father had an office in the Commodore Hotel. He would often use that postmark and influence there to get things shipped over to him quickly as possible. So there was that bit of influence there. But really, nobody knew about the full extent of his background. Just that, oh yeah, the kid came from money. Oh, and he's Ivy League educated. Yeah, you should be an officer. That was really about it. In fact, everybody knew that simply because he used to give German lessons to the officers in the recon troop at Petticoat Mansion, which is this mansion just outside of St. Clair's. They had regular lessons on, and he was the one that was giving lessons. And he would give to the officers, but he would also give lessons to any of the enlisted men that wanted to learn. He'd sit on his cot and just teach them phrases and stuff, just things that they would need to know if they were ever, you know, found themselves surrounded by the locals. And so he was just very generous with all that kind of stuff.
So as you said, they don't go across in those first waves on D-Day. They go across in later in July, late July 24th, I think I've made a note of. So when they get to France, how does he find France? What's he doing?
You know, again, he's part of the recon troop. Now, it's funny. I spoke to a veteran of that group, and he was very clear. He said, you know, what we did as recon, we were the guys always out in the front. We were always out on point. Our job wasn't necessarily to go out and engage the enemy. Now, certainly they had some weapons and armament, and you know, were mainly for defensive purposes. But their job wasn't to engage the enemy. Their job was to go out and find the enemy, find out where the Germans were, try to get an assessment of strength and exact position, and then radio that back to headquarters, or if it need be, messenger, you know, bike messenger or whatever, send it back to headquarters. And then at headquarters, they would then, based on the information recon was providing, adjust or continue with the battle plans as expected. But as this one veteran told me, as a recon troop soldier, you know, it sounds really nice on paper, but the only way they really had of locating enemy positions was to keep driving along until somebody started shooting at them. that's basically what they'd be driving these roads. All of a sudden, the fire would open up and they'd just hit the brakes, throw it into reverse, pull back, And then they would phone into the headquarters and wait for the infantry to come along. And that was their job. Unfortunately, it didn't always work out that way. And many times they had to engage the enemy. And in doing so, they would end up, you know, rounding up prisoners. And at which point, George, being able to speak German, would interrogate the prisoners on the spot. And therefore, they were actually in a bit of an advantage from a lot of recon troops, just because they were able to make on-the-spot judgments of battle conditions and situations just based on the information they were getting from captured German prisoners. And a few times, this is a very interesting side story, a few times they'd be driving along a road. This particularly happened in this one, I think it was the Chemois region of Belgium. They're driving along the road, and sure enough, the Germans opened fire. But they were so far away from the German positions, it made no sense for the Germans to open fire. Like, why would they have done that? You know, they basically gave themselves away, and then the recon troop realized they did it because they were surrendering. These guys were told, you know, the Germans were in retreat, they were pulling back. So these, you know, few soldiers that were left there, I don't know how many, you know, 20 soldiers, 30 soldiers, were told, hey, defend this spot, defend this line at all costs. And the Germans were like, you know, we're not doing that. So they waited until the recon showed up and they opened fire, you know, just to let them know where they were, and then surrendered. So it was like, you know, they made it kind of easy. So again, George was able to get information and send it back to headquarters. And sure enough, that whole town that they were about to go into was completely deserted. And so
his unit is actually awarded the Croix de Guerre, isn't it, for an action at Nuremberg?
Yes, in fact, they were. They had been going into this one town, and again, they were there to just to see where the Germans were. And they go into the town and find out that the town has basically been deserted by the Germans overnight. And so they sent a message back to headquarters saying, "Hey, the town is open. Just let's come and take it." So the general at the time says, "Well, can you guys hold it long enough for us to get the infantry up there?" And he's saying this to this private who's a messenger. The private's like, "Sure, we can hold it." What's he supposed to say? So he says, "Yes, sir, we'll hold the town." And they do. They end up going. And, you know, the Germans were – I don't say they were mounting a counterattack, because I don't think that's really appropriate. But they were trying to filter back into town, and the recon troop basically held the town, round up about 20 prisoners, including a German officer and a staff car and all this kind of stuff. And because of their actions that day, because again, they were on their own. They were literally, you know, 40 guys out there on their own against God knows what. They had no idea, but they held that town until the infantry showed up. I think it was a day later or something like that. So they were given a unit citation for that.
So yeah, they got mauled, didn't they, in the Hürtgen Forest?
Hürtgen was devastating. The whole division was just chewed up. And, you know, and sadly, it was a battle that should have never happened, should have never taken place. The Americans were thinking that, you know, the Hürtgen Forest, which is about a 50 square mile patch of forest and the German-Belgian border. And they were thinking that, oh, this is going to be a spot where the Germans could marshal all these troops and, you know, get ready to mount a counteroffensive. And what we need is go in there and clear it out. And it was a very ill-conceived plan. They also, the Americans thought that the Germans were controlling these dams on the Kahl River. And if they, you know, destroyed the dams and flooded the river, it would prevent, you know, armor from getting into Germany. It would just delay the advance through. And this is basically sort of the right shoulder swing of the entire assault into Germany. And it was just a very ill-conceived plan. The forest was so thick and so dense. And, you know, it's important to remember that the Germans had years to prepare this spot for the defense. This is part of the whole Siegfried line. So they were well entrenched. They've controlled the high ground. The Americans are basically attacking uphill through dense forest, through this knee-deep mud in just horrible conditions. And they were just decimated. The troop, just the 28th Infantry Division alone lost, you know, 6,000, you know, casualties. I mean, it was just staggering numbers. And the recon troop, their position was basically overlooking a dam on the Kahl River, and they were there to both direct artillery fire and also to see and to monitor the German troop movements, because again, if there was any sign that they were going to blow the dam, that, you know, they needed to act right away. Luckily, that did not happen. In fact, the Germans didn't have any plans to do that at all. They couldn't understand why the Americans kept attacking, because it was just such a suicidal attack. So that was where they were basically positioned, in the spot of the forest overlooking that area. And it was treacherous. At one point, the artillery was falling so fast and so frequently that they didn't know whose artillery it was. Was it German? Was it U.S.? They had no idea. But, you know, as luck would have it, the only casualty that the recon troops suffered was when they were being replaced, and they had a replacement troop coming in, and it was at night, and protocol said that when you have soldiers arriving at night, because the roads were, it was dark and things were unmarked and things were still very heavily mined, that you had to literally walk these new soldiers to the outlook position. So they were doing that, and they were basically, you know, there was a Jeep and a half track and what they call the M8 Greyhounds, which was the typical vehicle of the recon troop. And they were going along this road, and they ran over a mine, and it blew the floor out of the M8 recon vehicle, and also the Jeep. And it was when they only suffered their only casualty. There wasn't a fatality; it was just a casualty. So the recon troop got lucky, and it was after that that they got pulled back and pulled to the rear, and they ended up being assigned to this small little town in the northern part of Luxembourg called Eschweiler. And as we said earlier, Eschweiler was this little map dot town, maybe 200 people max, and it's basically a farming community. It was, the town itself was just 4 miles north of Wiltz, and Wiltz was at that time the headquarters for the 28th Infantry Division. So they weren't too far from divisional command, which is a good thing, but they were in this town all alone. And again, they got there in mid-November, and they were there to just rest and recuperate. They would occasionally go out on some patrols, at night patrols and things like that. And George would always be out on those patrols because, again, speaking German, they could get close to the German lines and just overhear conversations. And not that they really gleaned any information, because they really weren't talking about anything, but he was able to hear stuff. But while they were in town, interestingly enough, George was really the only person that could speak to anybody in town, because the Luxembourgers did speak German. They had their own language as well, but they also spoke German and French. So, you know, he was able to communicate with everybody. He even wrote like a little cheat sheet down for some of the people in town to communicate with other soldiers about things to say, like, I'll trade you milk for beer, or, you know, no, I will not go out with you. Things like little things like that on a little crib sheet. But he was also, George was a devout Catholic, and would go to mass and attend mass in this little local church every day. And he became fast friends with the priest of the church, Father Bodson. And in fact, Bodson had offered George and Cletus, I remember I mentioned his best friend Cletus, a room at the parsonage, he had a spare room at the parsonage. Now, at the time, the headquarters platoon had been billeted in these two homes, the Plachette House, which is where George and Cletus were, along with some of the other headquarters soldiers, and the rest of the headquarters soldiers were in the across the street in another house, the Huberty House. And basically, these soldiers were living amongst the villagers, and they were sharing meals with them. You know, some of them would help out doing farm chores, because what else were they going to do? There's nothing else to do in town. So they were just basically for a month living as these villagers, with these villagers, and sharing with them. And George, again, being very generous, shared whatever he had with the village, especially the children. You know, whenever he get the baked treats from home, he would just, you know, automatically pass them out to all the kids. And he attended mass every day. And again, he and the priest became fast friends and would often share, you know, stories about home. And in fact, the priest was famously recalls this one time where the priest seemed to be fascinated, Father Bodson was, about Texas, where George had been in, you know, at Camp Hood. And he was fascinated just by the overall size of Texas. And you know, and probably some of the movies they had seen too, or whatever. And he was trying to, and George was trying to make this priest understand that, you know, you could basically fit most of Europe into Texas. You know, he just had such trouble getting his head around that. And, you know, here's George trying to draw little maps and show like what, you know, where you could fit. And it was just, he just couldn't, I guess he just couldn't understand some just one state alone being that big and that vast. And so it was just a funny side story. But again, you know, this is what they did. They just lived in and amongst the people in Eshbach. And they did this for a month, month straight through.
It struck me, it must be very odd because this is the second time they've been occupied. But, you know, this occupation is liberation. But it must be a very peculiar time when they've had, you know, they've got foreign soldiers upon their land for the second time in 5 years. Occupying them.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Luxembourgers hated the Germans because, you know, let's remember back when they were again occupied in 1940, the Germans came in and they were basically annexing Luxembourg. They considered Luxembourg part of Germany and they were sort of welcoming the Luxembourg people back into Germany. And the Luxembourg are very proud people and they wanted no part of this. And despite the Germans' best efforts of re-education and, you know, Germanizing the population, they changed – the Germans did all the street names to German names. So in any particular town, the Grand Rue was changed to Adolf Hitler Boulevard or Hermann Goering, you know, way or something like that. All French-sounding surnames were changed to German names. They just changed families' names. All official documents were done in German. Basically, they set about to Germanize the population, and in that, they forbade the speaking of, you know, the Luxembourg language. It was outlawed. They outlawed the Luxembourg flag, and they, you know, they outlawed any local traditions and customs that were not sanctioned by the Germans, and in this case, the Nazis who had then come in and taken over the administration of this country. And so when the Americans came in September of 1944, September 10th, I believe, was the actual date. I mean, the people of Luxembourg couldn't have been happier. They welcomed it. I mean, it's like you were told, oh, you have to share your homes or whatever with American soldiers. They were thrilled. They were like, sure, absolutely, because, you know, they lived for nearly 4 years of just oppressive German occupation and Nazi occupation, and so they embraced the American soldiers as their liberators and their saviors. And that was the sentiment that carried through and still carries through to this day. They have not forgotten what that occupation was like.
So the Germans attempt to reoccupy, famously, in the Ardennes, the Watch on the Rhine, isn't it, is launched, which is to us is the Battle of the Bulge. It's 2 days before the fighting reaches the recon troop there. What are they? Are they ordered to hold? I mean, so many of these guys were just told to stay where you are and fight it out. Is this what happens to them?
Sure. But, well, partly, yes. You know, being a recon troop, they were given, you know, part of the time. You're right. December 16th, battle, you know, the Battle of the Bulge, the Ardennes Offensive, however you want to call it, erupts. And being the recon troop, they knew something was happening. Everybody knew something was happening, but nobody could figure out exactly what. You know, there was a lot of confusion in the early stages. And so, in fact, the recon troop got orders to go to Clairvaux, to drive up to Clairvaux, which is probably about 15 miles just to the north of Eschweiler. And because they had lost communications, the headquarters in Wiltz had lost communications with Clairvaux. So they wanted to, like, find out what was going on. So they dispatched a squad of recon soldiers up there to find out what was going on. And they could only make it so far because they basically ran into this wall of German invasion that was coming, you know, just coming through Clairvaux. And they had to, you know, basically turn around and hightail it back to Eschweiler and report on what they saw, which was like, this is a massive attack that's happening. But by the time they did that, it was pretty much understood that's what was going on. And the headquarters in Wiltz had ordered the holding, not just of Eschweiler, but all across the region there. All the troops were ordered to hold their position as long as they could. But by December 18th, it was clear that Eschweiler was not going to survive because they were nearly surrounded. By the afternoon on December 18th, up to this time, all these refugees had been going through town, so they knew something was coming. The people in Eschweiler were being evacuated because, again, this was a huge advance that was happening. So during that whole time, the recon troop was holding the town as long as they possibly could. By the afternoon of the 18th, nearly surrounded, and they were just, again, there's only a couple of roads in and out of town, so they were doing their best to block these roads and to you know, give cover into the woods. They were doing their best to hold it. They realized they just couldn't hold it anymore, so they were going to have to retreat. Vilt, the 28th headquarters, said, okay, come south to us, help us with our retreat of Vilt, because the headquarters was assumed to be overrun as well, so they were going to be pulling out. So the recon troop got orders to head south to Vilt to aid in the withdrawal of the headquarters unit in Vilt. So they hastily assemble this convoy and head out of town. And there was basically one of two ways to go to get south out of town. One of the ways was completely blocked off. So they said, okay, well, you know, we have no other choice. Let's get on the road. And they drive in this really hastily assembled convoy, I think about six vehicles, and they go driving down the road out of town. And if you go there, you'll see it. It's pretty open space until you hit this one wooded bend in the road, and then it gets kind of this tunnel of trees, and then it's you get out into the into a crossroads that heads into Vilt. So they had just about made that turn into this cluster of trees, and they ran right into a German ambush, and that's where their escape stopped. The lead vehicle literally swerves basically off the road to try to avoid running into a bit of German armor that was getting ready to come up the road. The Germans open up fire from the downslope berm to the left. These guys jump out of their vehicles and are using the upslope berm to the right and their vehicles for cover. And so sudden was this ambush that most of the guys jumped out of the vehicles without their weapons. You know, there really weren't a whole lot of options. Basically, death and capture were the only options available to them. And seeing this, there was George. And George saw all this and saw what was happening. And God only knows what possessed him. He said somebody had to do something. And so he jumps up onto the back of the Jeep that he was in, where there was a 50 cal mounted. And he cycles the action. And he starts laying down suppressing fire. And as he's doing it, he's shouting over over his shoulder back to the guys, you know, go for it, make a run, get out of here. So they do. They all scatter into the woods. There's about a 30-yard stretch of open field before they could actually make it to the cover of the trees. And he throws down enough suppressing fire to allow them to escape. And most of them do until the machine gun jams. So there's George. He's standing in the Jeep, and he's trying to clear the breach. And now these Germans are starting to return fire. And, you know, their bullets are flying, and they're pinging off the Jeep and off the trees and things like that. And he eventually, and miraculously somehow, doesn't get hit, clears the breach, reloads, and starts firing again. And the few stragglers that were still remaining, he again says to them, you know, get the hell out of here. And they do. They run. They make a run for it. And he basically allows all of them to escape. Seconds later, he is cut down by German bullets. And the rest of the recon troop, and this is a very interesting part of the story, of the soldiers, there's about 60 soldiers that were that left that day in that convoy, except for a soldier who was killed in the initial volley of bullets from the Germans, and George Mergenthaler. All the other recon troop soldiers survived that ambush and survived the war. Most of them had been taken prisoner. Some of them actually made it back to, I think 20 of them made it back to Allied lines, but they all survived the war. And so if you look at it today, there are generations of families in existence right now because of George Mergenthaler and the heroic actions that he did that one day.
So what condition is he in when he is picked up? Because he does become a prisoner, doesn't he?
He does, you know, and the sad part is nobody really knew what had happened. Some of the soldiers saw him as they were running, saw him get hit and saw him fall, and they assumed that he had died, that he was killed then. That was not the case, actually. What actually happened, and this is contrary to the story that's actually been told and been known, you know, and as somebody in Luxembourg once told me, it's that sometimes when a story gets told, that incorrect version gets told and retold and told again, and suddenly it becomes fact. And it wasn't by malice of anybody. It's just that this was the story that they knew. It was through the research that I had done for the book that I actually found out what really happened to George. And what happened was that he was wounded, probably mortally, certainly badly wounded. Nobody really knows for sure. And he was taken prisoner with a couple of other soldiers. And they were sort of on the side of the road, he and these other two soldiers, one of whom was a medic, without any supplies, by the way, because the Germans had stripped him of all his medical supplies. And they were basically looking after George as best they could. He was wounded in the neck and I think one other in the shoulder or arm or whatever. And a German officer comes over to them and starts asking them questions. And nobody knows what George said, but he said it to the officer in fluent German. And at that point, the German drew his pistol and shot George in the forehead. And that's how George died. And then he just told the other soldiers, bury him. And that was it. Unfortunately, because of, and we all know the Battle of the Bulge with the heavy snows and everything, the worst snows in, I guess, like 50 years in that region was at that time. Nobody found George's body until the snows melted in spring in March of 1945. So nobody knew what happened to him. Nobody at headquarters knew. His best friend Cletus, who had survived the ambush and who had made it to Allied lines, was with the headquarters troop unit, the recon troop, and nobody knew what happened to him. And they found out because villagers had found his body. By this time, you have to understand, he had so, George had so endeared himself to the people of Eschweiler, they considered him one of their own. So when they found his body buried, you know, in this crudely constructed, you know, stone-covered grave on the side of the road, Father Bodson went into Vils, bought, used his own money, bought a casket. They brought the casket back to Eschweiler. They dug up his body, put it in the casket, and they paraded the casket through town and reburied it in the town cemetery, which it's a huge honor, and it was this spot overlooking the valley, which where he had spent so much of his time, and it was a great honor to do so. And then it was the priest that actually wrote home to George's parents to explain what had happened, and that was the first time his parents knew what happened to George, because at that point all they knew was that he was still missing in action, and that's when the rest of the recon troop found out what had happened to him as well. But interestingly enough, that is not where the story ends. And if you flash forward after the war, so taken were George's parents. And remember, George was an only child. So taken were his parents by the love that the people in Eschweiler had showed to their only son, that they decided that despite the Marshall Plan and, again, being very wealthy, that they said, we will help you rebuild your church, because they knew that George had spent so much time in the church, and they knew that from the letters they had written home. The church had been heavily damaged in the fighting of the Bulge and all that kind of stuff. All the windows were gone. The mural, the hand-painted mural behind the altar was destroyed. The church organ was destroyed. So they said, we're going to help you rebuild the church. And they did. They funded the reconstruction of the church, and it took them a couple of years to do it. And they rebuilt the church basically stone by stone, just like it had been prior to the war, including the mural behind the altar, the hand-painted mural behind the altar. They got artists in to recreate this mural. And the mural was of Jesus feeding the masses. And in this case, however, he was being helped with that task by one of his apostles. And this apostle happened to be dressed in army drab uniform, and bearing the likeness of George Mergenthaler. And if you walk into that church and see that, Angus, it takes your breath away. And it was when I first walked in there, I was hooked, and I just said, oh, my God, what an incredible story. I have to write this story. So that is the story of Merg.
Amazing. I read that, and then I looked at the picture of it, and I thought, oh, it really does look like an American GI.
And it is.
It's incredible.
It's basically they draped him in a purple apostle's robe, but it's the robe over his army uniform, and it's his picture. And the picture, the face that's there is from one of the final photos of George Mergenthaler, which is also in the book, that was taken in Eschweiler by Father Bodson. Father Bodson was this amateur photographer, and he had taken pictures of George and Cletus and some of the guys, and those photos are in the book as well.
It's an amazing story. Now, the only thing that left me wondering after reading it all, and it is a fabulous story, is did they ever find the officer that shot him?
No.
Is that a dead end?
They never did. But an interesting side note to that is that George was given a bracelet by his father, basically an ID bracelet, and it had his name on it in his unit and in his ID number, his dog tag number. And in the back, it also said, please take care of this soldier. He's my son, George, Herman Mergenthaler, da, da, da. And interestingly enough, when they buried George, that bracelet was stripped from him, as were all of his possessions, except for his reading glasses. Years and years later, that bracelet found its way onto eBay, and it was bought by somebody in Luxembourg, in just outside of Eschweiler, who knew this story and recognized the name and bought the bracelet. And what had happened was it was an Austrian family whose father had served as in the German army, and who had had this bracelet. The father had passed away, and so they were going through his things, found this bracelet, and they just put it up online to sell because they didn't know anything about it. And it turns out that that soldier was one of the guys who was standing guard over the other two soldiers, the American soldiers, who were burying George's body. And so that's sort of like the only connection that we have to that very moment. But no, we don't know who the officer was. And we don't know what was said either, because neither of the two soldiers with George at the time spoke any German.
Intriguing. Now,
and I'll just say this also, as I mentioned before, this is the exact ending to George's life is not what's if you go to Luxembourg and on the roadside near to where his body was found, you'll see this monument, and you'll see next to that is a placard that sort of describes what happened. And in that, it tells you that, you know, George was, you know, tumbled out of the Jeep and was shot. This part of the story is not there. And the reason for that is because nobody really knew about it at the time. When I was doing my research for the book, I was talking to one of the recon troop soldiers who told me about this event. And he had said that, you know, in one of the recon troop reunions well after the war, as soldiers do, they start, hey, whatever happened to so-and-so? Hey, you know, what do you know about so-and-so? And George's name came up. Hey, remember George? Oh, yeah, we remember George. That's a shame what happened to him. And they were talking about it. And this one former POW said, oh, that's not where he died. I was with him when he died. And everyone's like, what are you talking about? And so he tells this particular veteran, whose name is Gene McHale, who I spoke to, tells him the story. He says, you know, and he was shot by this German officer. Oh, okay. And Gene tells me this. And it is the only accounting of this that I had heard. And I was like, you know, I had wrestled with putting it in the book. Should I not put it in the book? And I decided not to include it in the book because I just didn't. It was the only version of it that I'd heard. And I thought, you know what, maybe he's confusing it with somebody else. I better not put it in there. And then just before the book went to publication, I'd gone back to Luxembourg and decided to do one more round of interviews with people in Eschweiler. And I had just about finished up and I was talking to this guy whose father and grandfather were there, and he just starts telling me the story that this former recon troop soldier George McHale had told me, and basically tells me the exact same story. And he knew because that's what his grandfather had told him, because his grandfather was there. His grandfather knew what had happened. And I was like, are you sure? And he basically recounted the exact same thing, and then I realized, no, this is really what did happen. So this is the second accounting from somebody completely different in Luxembourg, unsolicited by me. And I said, okay, you know what? This is the true. This is truly how he unfortunately died. And you know, in fairness, Angus, he might not have lived anyway. He was so severely wounded, and they were gathering prisoners to ship eastward, you know, but to POW camps. So who knows what kind of medical treatment he would have received, or if he would have lived, or how gravely he was wounded. So it's hard to say, but fact of the matter is this is how he was killed.
Well, Peter, thanks for joining me and for sharing the story of George Mergenthaler. Listeners, if you want to read more about George, the book is Merg, a World War II soldier gave the town the greatest love. The town never forgot it. As ever, I will put a link to the book on the website, www.podcast.com/books. If you want to hear more from Peter and I, don't forget I've made it available to everyone, and you can find it at patreon.com/www2podcast. So in episode 100, I talked to Gene Metcalf, who parachuted into Nijmegen with the 82nd Airborne, as part of Operation Market Garden. So, until then, I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.